Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Every month we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee. We count that as anything from a 20th anniversary all the way up to a 100th. This is your devoted host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. And if you have just found our program, welcome. If you're a regular listener, we are, of course, delighted to have you back. 75 years ago, a film hit theaters that showed a decidedly different side of silver screen icon Humphrey Bogart, won acclaim and awards for actor Walter Huston, and proved to be a major comeback for his son, director John Huston, who had returned from service in World War II. This film has had a significant influence on many cinematic works to follow, from spaghetti westerns to the Indiana Jones franchise to even There Will Be Blood. Of course, we're talking about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, the thrilling western adventure noir hybrid that was originally released on January 14, 1948. Okay, in teasing this episode last month, I promised you some big-name guests, and I'm not going to disappoint. So joining me this month will be none other than Turner Classic Movies host Ben Mankiewicz. Yep, still pinching myself. And film scholar and blogger Farron Smith Nemi, who will be featured in back-to-back separate interviews. Wow, that's a heck of a 1-2 punch. Ben, Farron, and I will examine why Treasure of the Sierra Madre is deserving of its 75 birthday candles, its impact on movies and filmmakers, the Huston father-son team responsible for bringing this classic to life, and so much more. So sit back, enjoy a cold beer from the cantina, if you're so inclined, and prepare to strike it rich as the recipient of some in-depth and fervid conversation about this all-time classic movie. Prior to introducing our esteemed guests, let's say we learn a bit more about the who, what, where, when, why, and how behind Treasure of the Sierra Madre from the fine folks at Wikipedia, shall we? The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is a 1948 American Western written and directed by John Huston. It's an adaptation of B. Traven's 1927 novel of the same name, set in 1925, and follows two downtrodden men, played by Humphrey Bogart and Tim Holt, who join forces with a grizzled old prospector, Walter Huston, the director's father, in searching for gold in Mexico. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre was one of the first Hollywood productions to be shot on location outside the United States, within the state of Durango and with street scenes in Tampico, Mexico, although many scenes were filmed back in the studio and elsewhere in the U.S. The director first read the novel by B. Traven in 1935 and thought the material would make a great movie with his father in the main role. After a smashing success with his directorial debut, The Maltese Falcon, Huston started to work on the project. The studio had George Raft, Edward G. Robinson, and John Garfield in mind for the three main roles, but then World War II intervened. By the time Huston came back from making several documentaries for the war effort, Humphrey Bogart had become Warner Brothers' biggest star. When Bogart first got wind that Huston might be making a film of the novel, he immediately started badgering Huston for a part, and of course ended up with the plum role of Fred C. Dobbs. Though the dailies impressed Warner Brothers, Jack L. Warner nearly went berserk with the weekly expenditures. After viewing one scene, Warner threw up his hands and shouted to producer Henry Blanc, "Yeah, they're looking for gold, all right. Mine." During another screening of dailies, Warner watched Dobbs stumble along in the desert for water. Warner jumped up in the middle of the scene and shouted to a gaggle of executives, "If that SOB doesn't find water soon, I'll go broke." At the 21st Academy Awards, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre received 4 nominations and won 3. Best Supporting Actor for Walter Huston, and Best Director and Best Screenplay Writing for John Huston, the only Oscars he ever won. In 1990, the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is today considered to be among the best films of all time, with some critics calling it Huston's magnum opus. The American Film Institute's list of the top 100 American movies places Treasure at number 38, and on Rotten Tomatoes, the movie earns a rare perfect score of 100%, garnering a 9.2 out of 10 average rating from critics, as well as an audience score of 93%. Say, mister, can you stake a fellow American to a trailer of The Treasure of the Sierra Madre? Why, of course.
Up into the forbidding majesty of the great Madre Range go men, their past buried in silent secrecy, their futures hidden in the mystery of adventure. Men drawn together in their search for gold. Don, soldier of fortune. Howard, the old-timer. Curtin, the youngster. And Cody, the intruder. These are the men who tried to tap the treasure of the Sierra Madre. Men with an oath on their lips and muscles in their arms, but men with greed in their hearts. Ready to break their backs, to sell their very souls for gold, fighting shoulder to shoulder against the forces of nature, only to find their greatest enemy is human nature.
Shut your trap! Shut up, or I'll smash your head flat!
Go ahead, throw it! Without me, you two would die here more miserable than rats.
Leave him alone. Can't you see that the old man's nuts?
You're so dumb you don't even see the riches you're treading on with your own feet.
Better as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to keep that dame waiting, whoever she is.
We wounded this mountain. It's our duty to close her wounds. The least we can do to show our gratitude for the wealth she's given us.
You talk about that mountain like it was a real woman. Even a lot better to me than any woman I ever knew.
I know exactly what you mean. You want to take it all for yourself and cut me out. I know you for what you are. A long time I've had my suspicions about you. Now I know I've been right.
So that's your stinking game, is it? Informing. I knew you was an informer. I knew it all the time.
Take a look down that mountain. This means all our funerals.
What's that?
If I'm right in what I'm thinking, may the Lord be with us. They're not soldiers, they're bandits.
Let's see, where's that soapbox? Oh yeah, I left it over here. Hear ye, hear ye. I hereby announce that this meeting of the Spoiler Club will now commence. Those who have not yet viewed said film shall be forewarned that the forthcoming conversations will reveal key plot points that could detract from your initial watch of the motion picture under examination. All subjects who fit this description are hereby counseled to adjourn themselves from the podcast premises and screen said film forthwith, after which time they will be permitted re-entry to these proceedings. Yes, you in the back with your hand raised, you had a question or a comment?
Makes me sick, all this talking and fussing about nonsense.
Good point, Dobbsy. So without further ado, let's give it up for the one, the only, Ben Mankiewicz of TCM. It's my great pleasure to introduce to the Cineversary podcast, Ben Mankiewicz, renowned host of Turner Classic Movies. In years past, we've had the great fortune of welcoming your fellow TCMers, Eddie Muller and Alicia Malone, as guests on our show. And yeah, now we have a trifecta. So Ben, a big warm welcome to Cineversary.
Thanks for having me. I mean, I don't know why you had Eddie on the show, but I guess you couldn't get anybody else.
No, Eddie's a fan. And whenever we have a great milestone anniversary of a film noir classic, Eddie always seems to say yes. And we love having him here.
No, Eddie's the best.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in this episode, Ben, we're commemorating the 75th anniversary of Treasure of the Sierra Madre, one of the all-time great films of the 20th century. Ben, can you remember when and where you first watched Treasure of the Sierra Madre and your first impressions? And for that matter, is this one of your personal favorites?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a favorite. I don't keep specific lists. I don't know where it would go, but you know, it gets the Ben Mankiewicz top rating. I also don't know when I saw it first.
Would it have maybe been on television?
Yeah, almost certainly. Yeah. But the first time I saw it, it wouldn't have had the effect on me that it should have. But that's just the nature of my relationship with classic movies coming later than most people would expect who care about this kind of thing, given my name and my family background. Mm-hmm. But the person who brought this film to my attention was my mother, who played a surprisingly significant role in that it wasn't my father in a love of classic movies. And she got me to watch North by Northwest on television when I was, I don't know, well into it, well as a teenager, 15, 16, 17. And, you know, said I'd like it, spy movie, and, you know, and in my head it was in black and white, but we watched it on our color TV and it's not in black and white.
Okay.
So that's just a memory trick. But her favorite film was The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Wow.
So
okay.
Talked about it a lot. And it's also on you, because if I had had to pick my mother's favorite movie, I had to guess, that is not what I would have guessed. And she told me about it well before I'd seen it. So it was in our house, this sort of stand-in for Don't Be Greedy, right? Let me tell you about my favorite. I've told you about that movie with Humphrey Bogart, Treasure of Sierra Madre. And, you know, he gets so caught up in being rich and he's looking for gold and he betrays his friend and he loses his mind, right? And it ultimately costs him his life. So before I'd seen it, I knew what it meant, right? And I sort of knew what would happen. I don't remember the first time I saw it. I fully remembered exactly how it went. But she explained the film to me as a kid in a way that, well, it clearly mattered to her, right? It was a big deal to her. And that unquestionably stuck with me. So The Treasure of Sierra Madre was a metaphor before I'd even seen it and appreciated it as a movie.
Wow, how interesting. Yeah, thanks for sharing the personal recollections. How and why do you think Treasure of the Sierra Madre still matters 75 years later, Ben? Why is it worthy of being ranked as high as, I looked it up here, number 38 on the American Film Institute's list of the top 100 American films?
Well, I mean, I never know whether I give a good answer to that, or maybe I give the best answer to this.
I'm hoping for the latter.
But it's a good story well told. Right? So that's all it takes.
Sure.
There's a tremendous amount of humanity in this movie. I mean, in a movie filled with some really pointed overacting, it still manages to have this, again, this sort of, it does capture this authentic humanity, which I think made it exceptional for 1948, right? When, you know, movies have yet to see Brando, the method has yet to assert its influence where it raised the game, even of non-method actors.
Right.
So in many ways, the performances still play closer to a movie in the 30s than a movie in the 50s. Mm. But thematically, it's more like a movie made in 1967. Like, the ideas are well ahead of its time. And taking a leading man like Bogart, who couldn't have been more at the top of his game. Mm-hmm. I mean, this 1948 was like almost Bogey defined. Right. I mean, you know, High Sierra is 41 and Casablanca late 42, really 43. This is 5 years later that he is fully established as the, you know, with John Wayne, the definitive Hollywood star. Right. And probably even ahead of Wayne at that point.
Right. And this is John Huston's comeback vehicle after coming back from the war and their reunitement.
That's right. So they've made what I guess like, you know, three pictures together. At this point, I guess Key Largo was shot just before Treasure Sierra.
I think it was released afterward, but yeah, they're right around the same time.
Yeah, Key Largo came afterwards. I think I sort of have the feeling that production went ahead. It was first on Key Largo, but I might be wrong. Yeah, I mean, and their first, I guess there's a collaboration earlier, the Dr. Clitterhouse movie, but the real collaboration begins with High Sierra, which obviously Huston didn't direct, but he wrote. Right.
Yep.
And that's where and it matters that that's the movie that made Bogey Bogey. And it was, you know, it's Huston's screenplay. Right. Huston understood how to do well, you know, and that how to do, you know, a bad guy who you like. But here, there's really nothing much likable about Bogey for most of the movie, which I think made it very bold and very much ahead of his time. I mean, you like him early on in the bar because he's, you know, he does a thing that is heroic. Right. I mean, he gets his money from his boss. At the, you know, in the oil fields, by, you know, the guy tries to withhold the money from him. And when they beat him up, when he and Tim Holt beat the boss up, they take the money they're owed. They could take a lot more money, which theoretically they're entitled to. The guy tried to cheat them And he forced them to get into a fight. They're beat up.
That's right.
You know, they could take an extra 100 or 200 for their troubles. No one would fault them for that at that point. They could take all his money at that point. But they just take the 300 and they throw the rest of the money back down on this beaten guy who tried to rob them, essentially. So, like, you see, he's principled. Like, there's Bogey right there.
Yes.
Right? Things are bad. Things are tough. They lead a hard life. But here he is. He's principled. He's not going to take more than he's owed. But that turns pretty quickly once the prospecting adventure begins. And,
oh, yeah.
And I imagine audiences then were thinking constantly, well, he's losing it, but he's going to find it, right? He's going to find his heroic core, but that never, quite the opposite happens.
That's right. The transformation of his character from like sympathetic drifter to seemingly trustworthy team player to a venal, avaricious snake in the grass is remarkable. I mean, it's rare to see Bogey this sweaty, this nervous, and utterly despicable by the end of the movie. So it would have been a real eye-opener for Bogart fans and just movie watchers in general in 1948.
Because he doesn't even make a sacrifice at the end to save the other guys. Even if he'd betrayed them, he doesn't die for them. He just dies. Mm-hmm. He dies because he betrayed people, and he has no help, and he's on his own. I mean, he earned his death, but not through any sort of nobility, but through, you know, avarice, as you say.
And, exactly.
I just imagine that through the very end, even to the moment where he's killed by the bandits, you're thinking, well, wait, he's going to look, it can't just be your Bodhi died. He became a bad person and then he died because he was a bad person. There's no redemption whatsoever for the character.
Right. It's Humphrey Bogart and it's 1948 and you're used to him, you know, coming through and his character being redeemed, but that does not happen here. So poetic justice at the hands of the bandit with golden sombrero too. So
that's right, gold hat,
it's a real interesting way to end that character. Is this a film that remains in fairly regular rotation on TCM or one that remains maybe strongly requested by viewers?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, people respond to it. It's the reason you're talking about it on its 75th anniversary. You know, it definitely resonates with people because it stands out, right? I mean, pick a movie where a huge, likable star plays an irredeemable character in the 1940s, right? There just aren't many.
Yeah,
you're not gonna find it. Not without an ounce of redemption. You know, and we know, you know, Houston knew it. And, you know, while he was going over budget and taking up too much time, but he knew he had something special, you know, and when Bogey wanted to bolt, you know, Houston physically wouldn't let him. Like, you're going to finish this damn movie.
Bogart wanted to do his annual yacht race, and I guess Houston won that battle.
Yeah, of course Houston won that. I also love that he's playing, you know, he's playing Fred C. Dobbs. I mean, the guy couldn't be further away from a yacht race.
Exactly.
Just the fact that, I mean, it is so incongruous that Humphrey Bogart, he wanted to leave the production of Treasure Sierra Madre to be in a yacht race.
Yeah.
That does not comport. Yeah.
Now, speaking of anniversaries, this marks your 20th anniversary with TCM. Congratulations, Ben.
Yeah, thanks. This summer.
Yeah, what do you relish most about, you know, hosting at TCM and the opportunity to be an ambassador and a champion for classic films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
Well, you answered the question in the question. There's a lot of things to relish about this job, a lot of things to savor. But the most significant is, look, man, TV host is a soft job to begin with, right? I mean, you think about TV hosts and you think about, you know, made up, perfect hair, perfect teeth, smiling people who say nothing interesting. And I get it. This is sort of the career I chose. But I mean, when I get introduced as a TV host, I wince a little. There's only one thing worse, getting introduced as a TV personality. And even television news is fluffier than it isn't. There's less journalism in it and more talking heads. And the idea that I make a career out of being a talking head makes me super uncomfortable, literally. Even as I say it here, you can't see me, but I like wince a little bit as I say the words. But here I am in 2003, stumbling, really. You know, Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1940s, said luck is the residue of design. So there was some, it's not entirely luck. There was some residue of design in it, but here I am in 2003 and I get a job on television that matters.
Yeah.
That matters. I don't want to overstate it, right? But you know, because of what you do, that people who love these movies, it's part of their identity.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, I mean, I just, you know, you'd be like, I'm a mother, a lawyer, and I love dogs and classic movies, sometimes specifically TCM. Like, those are the things that people choose to identify themselves. You know, I'm a retired steel worker, grandfather, and TCM fan. Like, it doesn't, you know, nobody says that. No one says that about CBS mm-hmm. or ABC or CNN or even, you know, MSNBC or Fox News or anything like that. That is not what defines people. I mean, no, it's ridiculous that someone would ever say, oh man, I love Showtime, right? It's crazy. You might love a show on Showtime or multiple shows on Showtime, but nobody loves FX. But TCM matters.
Yes.
It matters in people's lives. And so to be the conduit there, to tell these stories, to connect mm-hmm. to connect viewers to their own past and the country's past and American history and world history and more, first and foremost, Hollywood history. Man, I can't believe I have a job on television as a TV host that makes that matters. And I work hard at it. I didn't anticipate it wasn't really hard the first 5 years. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it got very, there's a lot of work. But I love it. There's no job I can think of that I'd leave it for and no other job that I want.
Yeah, you guys have a great crew together and great camaraderie, great chemistry. So keep up the wonderful work. How do you convince someone, Ben, to watch an older film like this one? Especially a younger viewer who won't give black and white movies a chance. And for that matter, how can we better ensure that future generations will watch important works of the past like Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
Well, I mean, first, and this will seem like self-promotion, but it's true. We're the only people who do it, right? I mean, they're, you know, Criterion Channel, who we've partnered with in the past. We need the industry and the people who believe in the value of these films to stand up and support us. We're doing it. We took on this challenge. The viewers were our sort of ombudsman, right? They kept us honest. They very early on, it was like, oh, great, you're going to do this? Fantastic, great. Don't F it up. Do it right. And when we, you know, stray too far, make some mistakes, believe me, they remind us, right? So we need support, active support, loud support from our mainstream fans who care about this. Again, those people, those grandfathers and mothers and lawyers and dock workers who believe and who to whom these movies and this channel matters. We need them to shout from the rooftops how important we are. And we need those people who have great influence, filmmakers in this industry, who I know care deeply about us. You know, the Steven Spielbergs, Paul Thomas Andersons, Martin Scorsese's, Ava DuVernay's of the world, the people who have influence to make it clear that we're valuable. Mm-hmm. Because that lets us try to reach those young people, right? And it's hard because, you know, I got a 9-year-old daughter and, you know, she's like, is it black and white? You know, and then this is sort of like, all right, I'll watch. And she's come around, but, you know, it's hard. You know, things that are old seem like things that are part of your parents' generation or grandparents' generation. And when you're a young person, it's a tougher sell. To whom it's not a tougher sell, and we can use this a lot, is, you know, young filmmakers.
Right.
So, I mean, I hope and trust that in film classes all over the country, mm-hmm. Pictures like Tres de Sierra Madre are being shown and discussed. I mean, the thing that got me most interested in classic movies as a kid was nothing my family did. It was a random class at Tufts University that I took. Tufts had no film program to speak of, but there was a cinema class offered in the experimental college.
Okay.
If I'm remembering correctly. And I took it pass fail because I realized junior year that I could take like 7 pass fail courses before I graduated. It was the greatest discovery in the history of my life. And I took this film course pass fail figure and I just, like, you know, go and coast through it. Mm-hmm. But I was into it right away. I was into it. And I wrote a paper on the early 40s Warner Brothers Pictures called Santa Fe Trail.
Okay.
With Ronald Reagan and Errol Flynn. That was really a metaphor for World War II with the abolitionist, the violent abolitionist, John Brown, as sort of this messianic figure who clearly stood in for Hitler. And I wrote a paper on it in this pass-fail course. And I got the only A+ of my life.
It's a sign, right?
I mean, it was a sign one. My first reaction, of course, was not, wow, I should have a career talking about old movies. It was, I can't believe I took this course pass-fail, right? Right? I can't believe I made a gargantuan mistake.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I've never gotten a grade like this in my life.
Live and learn.
But I was into it, right? I liked writing that paper.
Mm.
So once people who care about movies, you know, are told, like, hey, the things you really like about movies aren't the CGI effects. The things you like are good stories, well told, to go back to my answer to your first question. Like, and this is what these are. These are good stories and they're well told.
Yeah.
They're professionally told, and it's told honestly. And I mean that in every sense. Like, don't get me wrong, I can fall for great special effects as much as anybody. Well, probably not as much as anybody, but but they tend to, I think, subtly erode truth.
Mm.
You know, that's the danger. It doesn't have to every time, and they can be handled well where there is no erosion of truth.
Okay.
But there is a degree of honesty lost in movies that seem fake, right? Well, there's nothing in the Treasure Sierra Madre that seems fake. Nothing. You know, with the perhaps exception of, I think, some definite old school acting that I suspect would make some young people be like, that's weird. You're telling me this guy was the greatest star ever? I'm like, yeah, he was. I know. Just
like, there's some wrinkles. Big picture. There's some wrinkles, but it's okay. Yeah. We love it anyway.
That's right. Oh, no. And in one sense, because I think the word dated has been weaponized unfairly. Like, yeah, it's dated. That's one reason why it's good. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So it is dated. It definitely, like, you know right away that, again, thematically, this could be a movie from 1971, but you look at it and you're like, okay, it's not. Right. This had to be, again, I say in some ways it feels closer to the performances feel closer to the 30s than the post Brando, you know, Jimmy Stewart after the war, 1950s.
Mm, right. So you've been hosting TCM's The Plot Thickens podcast for 4 seasons now. What do you especially enjoy about the show and your role?
Well, it's an opportunity for a new kind of storytelling on TCM.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever I complain about anything with my job, I always feel like I have to hammer in this gigantic caveat of how great it is and how fortunate I am to have it. And I really believe that. But, you know, I mean, doing nothing, introducing these movies is valuable. I want to keep doing that because that's our bread and butter. But podcasting and the boom of podcasting opened up this new avenue for us to tell stories with greater depth and in more detail. I mean, most of my lead-ins get shortened, right? Or, I mean, they don't actually get shortened. They pretty much let me say what I want. But I've been told, hey man, you can't make them this long. You got to keep them shorter. And I was like, I mean, I see Eddie's, you know, once a week Noir Alley lead-ins, and I love those. I mean, he's so good at it. And not every movie is worth 5 minutes, but there are a lot that I want to talk a long time on.
Oh, sure.
Well, obviously here, the podcasts give us an opportunity to tell over, you know, 6 to 10 episodes, mm-hmm. these big stories, you know, in 30, 35, 40, really 40 minute chunks. It's incredibly valuable. It's like making a documentary. It is like making a documentary. It's just with audio. And in some ways, doing it with audio is harder. I'm blown away at the talent of our, you know, Mike Vulgaris is our audio engineer. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's magic what he does. And being able to do these interviews. I came up as a journalist. That's what I was trained as a journalist. I went to journalism school. I worked as a journalist for 10 years.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So it's not fully journalism, but, you know, we have a point of view and we're trying to get a point across. And if something, even if it's true, doesn't seem to fit with our story, we'll leave it out. Right.
Right.
But there's still a lot of journalism in it and it's still true. Right. We're still telling truth. So I love it. And our podcast executive producers, I don't know that I've ever collaborated with anybody smarter, and I've worked with a lot of smart people, Angela Carone. So I love working with these people.
That's great to hear.
Yeah. So I couldn't enjoy doing the podcast more. And I was clamoring to do a podcast for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I had some ideas of what that podcast would be. And I really wanted to do it. And the podcast we're doing is nothing like what I wanted.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Things shake out differently than you expect.
That's right. But it's better. What do you know? They were smarter. and so I'm thrilled to be doing this.
Yeah. That's great to hear. Keep up the fantastic work with it. So anything noteworthy on the horizon that you might be involved in? Is there a special TCM event or an appearance, maybe a book or a side project that you'd like listeners to know about?
I do not have a book coming out this year.
Okay.
But we're already working on the 5th season of The Plot Thickens. I'm traveling to Europe as part of getting that podcast on the air, and I'm looking forward to that. At the age I am, I have never been to London, so I'm excited for that. And you know, our first ever TCM cruise in 2023 leaves from, I mean, it's our, I think, 9th cruise, but we're leaving from San Diego. First time we've left from the West Coast, TCM Film Festival back in April. And you know, we've got new bosses again for feels like the 4th time in 4 years, something like that. And I just feel like we got the right bosses, right? We got, our new boss, David Zasloff, who's redoing Robert Evans's home in Beverly Hills. He wants to live there.
He
understands movie history and he cares about it. He's connected. He's a powerful guy with connections in town. relationships with important filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like this is a guy who understands what we do and that he's, for the most part, going to let us do it. And that makes us all happy to work for somebody who understands.
That's great to hear.
Who understands what TCM is.
Mm, absolutely.
And why, and not just what it is, but what it is and why it matters.
Yeah. No, that has to feel good. So I have to ask you, Ben, the world wants to know, is Ben Mankiewicz a popcorn guy or a candy man? What's your favorite movie theater snack?
Well, candy would definitely be popcorn. Popcorn, I don't know. I don't like popcorn. No, I don't hate it. And there are times, and I tell you, I had an ex-girlfriend, a woman named Lou Parker. She was a TV anchor here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We dated for like 2.5 years. And she would put jalapeno peppers on popcorn.
Really?
And I guess that's a thing some people do. Yeah. She's Southern. And that was very big for me for a while.
Oh, okay.
Like that. Yeah. That was a very potent combination that I was into. But basically, you know, I still, you know, I'd go Juji Fruit.
Oh,
Junior Mint.
Old school. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I still can't. Dots are a poor man's Juji Fruit.
You're preaching to the choir, brother.
Yeah. I mean, I'll, you know, Whoppers.
You can't go wrong.
I mean, there's a lot of candy that I enjoy at a movie, but popcorn, if I note that they have jalapeno peppers available, then I'm into it. You got to put them on and then you got to switch containers so that the jalapenos are mixed in and some of the jalapeno juice sort of flows throughout the popcorn.
Wow. I think you got a cottage industry just waiting to happen. You just need to slap a label on it, yeah. Ben, and take it to town. That sounds really tasty. Well, Ben, thanks for taking the time to look back with us today on Treasure the Sierra Madre, celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, one of our shared favorite films. We really appreciate your time, and you have a wonderful day.
Hey, thanks. Pleasure talking to you. Love talking about these movies, so anytime.
Likewise. Thanks, Ben. Did that really happen? Did I really just have a 25-minute conversation with the current world ambassador of classic movies? Yeah, I think I actually did. It's a charmed life I live, folks. What can I say? My thanks again to Ben Mankiewicz for his time, his recollections, and his opinions on Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And now we pivot to another highly respected voice in the realm of film analysis as we continue our Valentine's Month audio love letter to Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Next up is Farron Smith Nemi. I've been reading her work and enjoying her collaborations with the Criterion Collection for many years, and now I have the privilege of introducing her to our Cineversary podcast. How exciting. Let's welcome Farron Smith Nemi, whose writings have appeared in Film Comment, The Village Voice, Sight and Sound, and her blog, Self-Styled Siren. Farron, thanks ever so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm so happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
So let's talk Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Do you recall when you first watched this or what your first impressions were?
I was thinking about this. I don't recall exactly when, but I think that's because it was really early. You know, like I'm thinking I was not out of middle school. So I would have been like somewhere between 10 and 13.
Okay.
And I would have seen it on TV with commercials, pan and scan, mm-hmm. like all of the, and I was all the same, just mesmerized by it. Mm. I really took to this movie. I think it's easy to love.
You know? Yeah, agreed.
And it really caught me up in the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all these years later, removed from that first viewing or two, what do you think about the movie today? Is this one of your personal favorites? And if so, why?
You know, it's funny because, you know, like it would probably not be. I participated in the Sight and Sound Best Film of All Time thing. That's just 10 films, so it's ridiculously short to begin with. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm not sure, you know, like how big a favorites list would have to be for me to put this one on it. And yet I think it's a terrific movie. I'm always happy to rewatch it and go back to it. It's really something of a pinnacle of the 1940s to me. So, you know, I guess maybe, you know, when you're talking about favorite movies, you're often talking about something maybe that, you know, spoke to you in a deeply personal way.
Sure.
And Treasure of the Sierra Madre to me is just more on the lines of a great adventure story, you know, a hugely entertaining time at the movies.
Yeah, no, you can't argue that. And I agree. I mean, it's not a personal favorite as far as a top 10 or 20 or something like that. I do kind of rank things. My friends know this about me, but that doesn't mean it suffers in quality or isn't list worthy in any way. It's just there's so many great movies to choose from. And I agree, especially for the 1940s in this era, the classic Hollywood era of the studio system. This is one of the best, in my opinion, and could be my favorite Humphrey Bogart picture, too, although it's hard to argue against Casablanca. I would say it's definitely John Huston's best movie for me. I know there's a lot of contenders for that title, but we could talk a little bit about Huston and his work if we have time in just a bit. So let's dig a little deeper, Farron. Why does Treasure still matter today in 2023? Why do you think it deserves to be celebrated 75 years later? And in what ways has it stood the test of time?
I think it's still an immensely watchable, quotable movie. Mm. And it's interesting to me, like I guess maybe 2 or 3 years ago, Spike Lee came out with Five Bloods.
Yes.
And watching that movie, I went into it pretty cold. I knew it was about Vietnam veterans going back to Vietnam. Mm. But, you know, I'm maybe 15, 20 minutes. I'm like, this is Treasure of the Sierra Watch.
Pretty much, right?
it's certainly not a straight remake, mm-hmm. nor is it in any sense a ripoff. It's very much Spike Lee taking a movie that obviously meant a great deal to him and kind of extrapolating certain points, you know, and putting them into a modern setting. And I thought he really did that superbly well.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
then I came across something that Paul Thomas Anderson did for the DGA website. I don't know if you've seen this.
Yes, I have. I know where you're going. Go for it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he sat with somebody and watched the movie with them and just did a commentary on it straight through. And he said that when he was making There Will Be Blood, he watched it over and over again before he went to bed because he wanted something that was just a really straightforward, superbly executed piece of story.
Isn't that interesting? It reminds me of the story of how Orson Welles watched Stagecoach while he was preparing to film and produce Citizen Kane. And it just speaks to, you know, great filmmakers will kind of latch on to another filmmaker's imagination. And this is a great example of that. So isn't that so interesting? Like a film like There Will Be Blood in some way has some DNA that's shared with Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Yeah, I mean, when I was watching it this time, I was struck by there's such a spoiler phobic thing going on now in film culture. You know, nobody wants you to tell, like, you know, the details of a plot or whatever. We've gone from, you know, thinking the ending is a spoiler or the twist is a spoiler, mm-hmm. to thinking like kind of giving any detail or describing a scene is a spoiler. So you watch Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and what's really striking is that this is a movie that just deploys foreshadowing all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Really, I think, you know, like anybody who is any kind of a sophisticated viewer, you know, or mm-hmm. or just experienced with movies is going to watch it and, you know, and know where this plot is going. You know, you see Humphrey Bogart talking to Walter Huston in the Flophouse, and he's like, well, you know, like I wouldn't go crazy with the gold. You know, I would just take my part and like leave. And you're thinking, no way.
Yeah, I know where this is going. Yeah, they telegraph things a little bit, but it's okay. It's all right. It's not like the movie is ruined for you if you sniff it out well ahead of time. It's a morality tale.
I think it's quite brilliant. I actually mm-hmm. think it's a virtue, because now instead of waiting, you know, just to see what happens, you're waiting, you know, for what you know is going to happen.
Sure.
And that is its own kind of anticipation, right?
Right.
And I think that may be a little bit of where it influenced There Will Be Blood, because I feel like There Will Be Blood, there are certain things in the course of that movie that you're pretty sure are going to happen, mm-hmm. right? But you're waiting for them. You know, you're waiting for certain things to go south, certain right. relationships to turn in on each other. when I watched this again, I was like, you know, maybe that is one of the things that PTA picked up on there.
Yes, I totally agree. You may guess the ending well ahead of time, but it's not so much the destination, it's the journey, it's the character arc, it's the microscope look at these three characters that is so fascinating to me. In answer to this question, I'm just going to chime in here a little bit with some of the thoughts I had. The film was helmed by one of the greats of the classic Hollywood era, right? John Huston. And
right.
This was a guy renowned for a distinctive style across several genres, including, yeah, it's a Western of sorts. He did noir, of course. He did adventure dramas. But with this story, Huston continues his exploration of disparate individuals, or misfits, if you will, who band together for a mutual purpose, usually for the pursuit of wealth or the quest of an elusive target. And other Huston films that follow this formula include, you know, The Man Who Would Be King, The Asphalt Jungle, Moby Dick, The Maltese Falcon, Beat the Devil. So he's pretty consistent in a lot of his movies in terms of following that kind of formula, if you will. But Treasure of the Sierra Madre is also memorable, Farron, for its visual realism to me, you know, its verite-tinged cinematography. To me, it's no small point that most of the scenes were filmed outdoors in Mexico, and I think that graces the picture with sociocultural and aesthetic authenticity. In fact, I was reading that this is one of the first Hollywood movies to be shot on location outside the U.S. within, I guess, Durango and Tampico. So you may say, what's the big deal? Well, remember that a lot of Hollywood films are just, you know, shot on a back lot or something in Burbank, California. It's a big deal to go out on location for the majority of the shoot here in Mexico. It's barren, harsh conditions and so forth, too, which is difficult on your actors. And I think that realism really shines through. I also like that this movie, I think it's aged more gracefully. Tell me if you disagree. Because most of the Mexican characters are played by Mexican actors or non-professional natives. Yes, we have the little trivia note of Robert Blake, a young Robert Blake, portraying a Mexican child. He's not Mexican, right?
Yeah.
But virtually every other Mexican character in Treasure of the Sierra Madre is performed by a Mexican native or Mexican American. You know, you consider at this time, what are we used to seeing? Well, American actors were often cast at this time to play Hispanics or Blacks or Native Americans and wear dark makeup to hide their whiteness. And that is really cringeworthy all these years later. So I give some extra credit to Treasure of the Sierra Madre and John Huston for staying authentic ethnically there.
Another thing that I was noticing on this go-round as well was, like a couple of years ago, there was a lot of discussion of Steven Spielberg having passages of unsubtitled Spanish in West Side Story. And watching Sierra Madre this time, I was like, you know, there are some points where they really go quite a while without a word of English spoken.
You must be reading my crib notes because this is my exact next point I was going to bring up. So yeah, we are simpatico here. I totally agree about the subtitles. Isn't it interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, when Tim Holt Curtin comes back to town, you know, to get supplies, and we see the Federales, you know, with the bandits that they've caught, and you know that there's like this to and fro, like with them asking the townspeople what's going on, and then the bandits answering, and the Federales talking to them, and you know, and it goes on for at least a minute, maybe longer,
yes,
which is long in screen time, you get a loose explanation of what's going on, but you never find out exactly what they're saying to each other if you are not a Spanish speaker. I don't recall reading a lot, you know, like I don't think James Agee or some of the other contemporary reviews that I've read really kind of even saw it worth mentioning, but I think that also deepens the texture of where you are.
Yeah, completely
and also
agree.
Makes you feel that the Mexicans are being treated with, you know, respect.
Absolutely.
They're not, you know, being played like with accented English in their own country. You know, they're speaking their own language.
Yeah, it's no small point. I think refraining from using subtitles and not having characters constantly translating Spanish to English for the audience's benefit, I think it makes many of us as culturally disoriented as Dobbs and Curtin, not Howard, because he is fluent in Spanish in the character, but it further immerses us in their world, right, as outsiders in this foreign land. But this decision, I think it also speaks to Huston's faith in the intelligence of his audience to figure out what they can in context and abandon, you know, any language concerns that they can't decipher. Because you're absolutely right. There are long stretches where Howard isn't interpreting what, you know, the natives are saying.
Yeah,
it's really interesting to me because not that using subtitles was a common practice in Hollywood movies at this time. You almost never saw it. I can't even think of another contemporary film that did it.
Yeah.
But again, you're choosing, you know, to shoot in Mexico and set the story there. You're going to have a lot of native characters and they're going to speak their native language. And boy, that's commitment, right? That's having faith in your audience.
Yeah.
I think Treasure also deserves to be celebrated because it's a showcase role for its lead, Humphrey Bogart, who plays against type. He isn't afraid to get dirty, literally and figuratively, as this character.
Yeah.
While some have criticized Bogart's portrayal as being overacted or exaggerated, others appreciate how Bogart, who, when he plays a lead character, usually plays a likable personality who's in control and, you know, maybe two steps ahead of everyone else. But here he's at the mercy of external forces and he succumbs gradually to paranoia and to animalistic impulses, right? So it's rare to see Bogart squirm.
Yeah. I find his performance exaggerated, really. I mean, Dobbs, he's just that kind of, he's a complainer. You know? And he's very theatrical in the way that he complains, you know. And in his conception as a man who the world has wronged, Bogart really seems to understand what it means to be one of these guys who, you know, like, you know, they're down on their luck, but it's not their fault. Really, nothing was ever their fault. The script does not give Dobbs really any background. We don't know how he wound up there. We don't know, like, if he was ever married, what's going on.
True.
He's just there, you know. And but I feel like Bogart, merely by dint of being Bogart, and, you know, and via, you know, his talent as an actor, you feel this as, you know, like a fully rounded character with a past.
Sure.
You may not know what that past is, but you can feel it there. He famously told a reporter before filming started, you know, I play the worst shit you ever saw in your life.
That's right. I read that.
I also feel that, you know, he's one of those huge actors like John Wayne or James Stewart, where they can play a villainous or an unsympathetic character completely straight and still bring some sympathy along with them simply because of their, you know, charisma as a star, right?
Right.
You know, I feel for Bogart the worst things get for him in that whole agonizing end sequence. I feel for him, not because the character has suddenly gotten any nicer. He certainly hasn't. And not because Bogart as an actor, I think, is really asking me for any sympathy. It's just there, you know, because his humanity is there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Absolutely. We do have to mention, if we're talking about acting, I mean, you could argue that Bogart is outshined here by Walter Huston, you know, the father of the director. This is a rare instance in a classic Hollywood feature of a son directing his father. It's so interesting, the familial dynamics at work in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. But as far as acting, I mean, Walter wins the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for so vibrantly bringing the old prospector Howard to life. It's a great, great supporting role that arguably outshines everybody else and really kind of steals every scene he's in. And so many memorable turns and lines by Howard, and the laughing is just contagious by the end of the film and so forth. So just had to give a few props here to Walter Huston because I think he carries the picture to a large extent along with Bogart. And let's not forget, you know, Tim Holt. You could argue he's a forgettable actor, character actor by this point, but he also starred in, you know, The Magnificent Ambersons, and he does have some acting chops. And I think it's a well-cast actor here in a good role, too.
I wrote a piece about Tim Holt for Film Comment a while back. And one of the roles that I focused on was Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And I mean, I love him in this movie. He's really almost kind of a self-effacing actor. You know, it's not hard to tell why he never became a big star. Well, number one was he never really chased stardom. he was fine with doing B movies as long as they were quality B movies. But I think another reason was that he didn't have that thirst for the limelight, you know, that you can see even in Walter Huston, who often played leads himself. But Holt is, you know, he's just there. He's an intense reactor. He listens really closely. He's frequently an audience surrogate.
Absolutely.
You see him twigging to how nuts Dobbs is right at the same time as we are, right? I think that's important as well. He walks very softly in this film. And I think it's a perfect balance because, you know, if he were as blazing as Huston and Bogart are, it would throw the movie out of whack.
Yeah, totally agree. He's the go-between. He is the surrogate for the audience in a lot of ways. And later, if we have time thematically, I want to talk about how, you know, there's kind of a triangle at work here. And there's so many interesting facets to that. Last point about just how the movie still matters to me anyway. I think the film plays as a hybrid of sorts that works clearly as a Western and an adventure movie, but it's also infused with film noir elements, right? Because, you know, you think about the prevailing cynical tone, the pessimistic worldview of many of the characters, the high contrast lighting and key scenes. You ruminate on the devolution of Dobbs from a down and outer with some semblance of morals earlier in the movie to a duplicitous would-be murderer emboldened by greed and avarice, the kinds of traits we often see in a gritty urban crime drama, otherwise known as noir, right? So I just find that really fascinating that, and it's not like this is the one and only or the first or last time that a Western has been infused with noir elements, but Huston, I think, really brings that pedigree to a hybrid film like this so well.
Yeah.
We were talking just a little bit about influences, films or filmmakers inspired by Treasure of the Sierra Madre. You mentioned Defy Bloods by Spike Lee. Can you cite any others? There are some obvious ones that we could probably agree on, but maybe some ones that are a little bit more evasive.
That was the first one that I thought of. You know, I mean, I think Three Kings.
I forgot about that one. That's right.
So, I saw Sierra Madre in that one. I tend to think of the film whenever I encounter like a largely male movie about people treasure hunting where I know everything's going to fall apart by the end of the film, right? Uh-huh. I can see certain visual elements of it that, you know, clearly went into Indiana Jones.
Oh, sure.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah, the fedora hat, the, you know, the rugged, dirty appearance of Indiana Jones. And that takes a cue from Dobbs, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. Those would be the first ones I would think of. Mm-hmm. I mean, what were you going to say?
Of course, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then there's Huston's own adaptation of The Man Who Would Be King from 1975. That story certainly shares some you know, DNA with Treasure of the Sierra Madre. There's a film called Trespass. I've not seen this. This is 1992, but apparently the story, it bears a lot of similarities. This is kind of a reach, but did you ever see the sequel to City Slickers? The Search for Curly's Gold. I think it's right there in the subtitle. Yeah, they're definitely riffing on Treasure of the Sierra Madre there.
I saw City Slickers, but not The Search for Curly's Gold. I'll take your word for it. You know, this whole setup, it can easily go comic. You know, there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Oh, sure.
I'm so sorry. I did not look up which one, but there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon where Humphrey Bogart keeps coming up, you know, and saying, say, could you stake a fellow American to a meal?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've seen it. I just don't know the name of it or the, I can't cite the year or whatever, but yeah, it's one of those famous Looney Tunes. And then, although the level of political commentary, you could argue it's minor in this movie, but Treasure's moral about the consequences of greed and betrayal, you could make a case that it's a fitting precursor to the message movies and the socially conscious Hollywood pictures that came in the 50s and 60s. I know it's a bit of a reach, but it has been brought up in the literature, and maybe there's a through line there, maybe not. So it's just interesting to trace the lineage of Treasure of the Sierra Madre to, you know, more contemporary films. And it speaks to the lasting influence, again, of this picture. Yeah, let's talk a bit about John Huston, because he earned his only Best Director Academy Award for directing this movie, What stands out to you, Farron, about his directing choices in Treasure?
I mean, I would not call his direction necessarily invisible, as you know, as some people have called it. You know, I mean, I feel that he's really good at blocking scenes or whatever and having people move through things. I loved in the Paul Thomas Anderson article where he was pointing out how much of this movie is just the three of them sitting around a campfire, having conversations of varying tenseness. And Houston does, in fact, keep that really interesting. Like with its details and things, I feel that, you know, he's very good at drawing my attention, like during an action scene when the bandits are having their short conversation with Humphrey Bogart, Dobbs, the famous, you know, like, I don't have to show you any stinking badge scene. The attention that's given to the watch, you know, is both subtle and not subtle. He doesn't zoom in on the watch, and yet you're watching the watch, right?
Yeah, it's little touches like that. I think as he proved in his cinematic translations of written works like The African Queen, Moby Dick, I don't know if you ever saw The Dead, The Maltese Falcon, The Asphalt Jungle.
Fat City.
I mean, so many. It's really a very great filmography. But he had a clear gift for adapting acclaimed stories as both a director and often the screenwriter on many of his films. And this is certainly true here because Treasure is no exception. It's little surprise to me that Houston won dual Oscars for this picture. He did win Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Director. I agree. It's not necessarily invisible directing. So if you were to kind of, you know, parse through what makes Treasure so great as far as a directed film, it's tightly paced, it's straightforward, it's simple to understand, and I think it's free from extraneous subplots, from unnecessary side characters and showy directorial flourishes.
Yeah,
I believe there's no frivolous scenes or ham-fisted dialogue. Now, that's an arguable point to some people, but I really think it's a very streamlined movie. And it is over 2 hours, which speaks to, if you are a fan, it goes by really quick. And that's a long runtime for a 1948 film. So to me, we're intently focused on three things. Number one to me is the interdynamics between the three men. The progress or lack thereof in their quest for riches is number two. And number three in my book is Dobbs' riveting descent into villainy, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes the best directorial efforts, they involve following the straightest path to success, you know, letting great actors tell a great story. So I think Houston gets out of the way in a lot of instances here. He's not, you know, trying to do the bravura, showy, picturesque camera movement or something like that. And from what I've learned, I guess he closely worked with his actors. He often urged them to improvise, and he was remembered for fostering a relaxed ambiance on set, which commonly resulted in remarkable performances. You know, the filming of Treasure, as we were talking about, it was strained. And that's due to the longer than expected shoot under harsh conditions in Mexico. But from what I gathered, Houston really lightened the mood. He liked to play practical jokes on the actors. And he, you know, it sounds like he didn't take himself too seriously. I could be wrong about that.
But I think on this film in particular, there were some other films where an actor here or an actor there would have a hard time with him. Mm-hmm. In his autobiography, you know, he presents himself as kind of the most reasonable man you ever saw in your life. But, you know, but there were, like Montgomery Clift, I think on both Freud and The Misfits, had a really hard time with Houston. Mm-hmm. But when he was getting along with all of the actors, certainly that was true on The Maltese Falcon, then it was a good time being on a Houston set.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfair to paint with too broad a brush and just assign, you know, the characteristics of the Treasure shoots to other Houston productions. I'm sure there's many different, you know, good and bad qualities to the director, but the proof is in the filmography to me. What I like about Houston from what I've read and understood is that he was famous for taking risks and staying faithful to his vision. Such as, you know, for example, insisting on writing Bogart to glory instead of other actors. He really stood by his decision to cast Bogart in, for example, Maltese Falcon and this film when the studio was putting pressure on him to think about other actors, for example. Indeed, I think Houston brought out the best in Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
Because Bogart played four of his finest roles for this director. So in addition to Treasure, Bogart starred in six movies for Houston. But the big ones, of course, are The Maltese Falcon, Key Largo, this film, and The African Queen, and the last movie for which he won a Best Actor Academy Award. So let's dig a little bit into themes or messages or morals to the story, if you will, Farron. So what would you take away here in terms of maybe a major theme or message that can be mined from Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
Well, it's not a movie that buries its themes.
No, ma'am.
they're pretty much right in your lap.
Sure.
Clearly, it's about the madness of greed, you know, loyalty and lack thereof, right? It can even be looked at as a thing about the morality of gold mining itself, you know, both environmentally, yep, and in terms of the fact that they're in this country, it's not their country,
right,
and yet they're prepared to take its gold, mm-hmm, out of there, you know, without any kind of permission. It's also about what are your duties and obligations as a stranger in a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
I think the movie is really, you know, trying to look at that. But above all, it definitely is about greed versus loyalty. And you see that in several different things, as when the mine caves in on Dobbs. And there's that great shot of Curtin's back. You know, and you can see, you know, it's a shot of his back. It's a very nice moment in Tin Halt's performance.
Mm.
But you see that back considering, should I just leave him there?
Yeah.
You know, it's more gold for me.
Absolutely, you know? Right. Yeah, there's a turning point there where he could have gone south. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then he turns around and he drags them out. And, you know, and does he get gratitude from Dobbs? Well, not bloody much.
So, nope. No rest for the wicked and no honor among thieves there. So absolutely, lots of juicy themes to, you know, pull from Treasure. And I'm going to riff on what you said first off, because you can't deny, I mean, the corrupting influence and power of greed is at the heart of Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Mm-hmm. Everybody can agree on that. As the story advances, you think about Dobbs and how he increasingly demonstrates how avarice can grip the soul and strip you of empathy and strip you of allegiance or even compassion. And the fact that You said it, you know, Curtin saves Dobbs' life, Howard saves Dobbs' life, and they're willing to trust each other and collaborate fairly. It doesn't prevent Dobbs from double-crossing them and attempting to even murder Curtin. It just says so much about the grip that greed has on his soul. Treasure is a kind of a cautionary tale about the dangers of unbridled materialism, maybe how a tunnel vision pursuit of wealth, it inevitably results in, you know, moral decay and the dissolution of trust and friendship. This most recent rewatch, I really paid attention to, there are some things that are telegraphed or there are motifs, right? There are some repeated patterns in the film too. Dobbs devolves into this inhuman animalistic being as the story advances, right? But riffing on that theme, Farron, the film is replete with mentions and appearances of animals and creatures, both common and exotic, like donkeys or jackasses are mentioned, tigers.
Or the Gila monster.
Yeah, the Gila monster, dogs, they mention lions, foxes, buzzards, swine,
yeah,
birds, monkeys, ants. I don't think this is just in the service of the story and just, you know, the vernacular of the characters. I think Houston and the collaborators here are going for something in terms of, you know, reminding us that there are animals all among us and within us, too. As you were saying, like, you have self-interest versus altruism or the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
There's a clear dichotomy between the selfish and mistrustful nature of Dobbs, and you compare it to the more generous, trusting, and compassionate Howard.
Mm-hmm.
What does Howard do? Well, like Curtin, he pledges to donate a portion of his treasure to Cody's family. As you were mentioning, in terms of the eco-consciousness, he encourages the group to repair their damage to the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He agrees to help this sick young villager. And what does he have to do in the process? Well, he has to leave his share of the gold in the hands of his partners during his absence. So Howard really demonstrates how you can still be an upstanding human being despite temptations and risks and so forth. What I really love in terms of, you know, digging deeper into thematic elements here is just exploring this triangle that I was mentioning earlier, because I think it is a pretty clear triangle. It's not a love triangle like you'd have in a romance or something, but it's a love-hate triangle, if you will, because what are the three points in the triangle? It's obviously Howard, Dobbs, and Curtin. They form a character triad in which, you know, okay, so one point on the triangle is Curtin, right? And he stands between these two practically diametrical opposites in Dobbs and Howard, and he's pulled in either direction at various points in the story. So I want to read you now a quote from Roger Ebert in his great movie Essay on Treasure. He said that this is a story in the Joseph Conrad tradition, using adventure not as an end in itself, but as a test of its characters. It involves moral disagreements between a wise old man and a paranoid middle-aged man, with a young man forced to choose sides, unquote. So I really jibe to what Ebert was saying there. And then I'm going to throw this at you, Farron. You tell me what you think about it, because it could be far-fetched. It could be a little bit pretentious. But from a psychological perspective, maybe you make a case that Dobbs, Curtin, and Howard could represent, you know, you've heard of the Freudian psychoanalytic theory of the id, the ego, and the superego, right? If you you know anything about that theory, it's that the superego serves as the conscience and the moral compass of our personality. And that fits with Howard, you could make a case. The id pertains to that part of our mind driven by instinctual, primitive, and immediate gratification urges. And I guess that somewhat describes Dobbs. And the ego is the mind's more rational and realistic component that mediates between the id and the superego. And that's Curtin, right? So it's interesting how the id dominates and attempts to destroy the ego once the superego and Howard temporarily leaves them. I just found that really interesting.
It's interesting. We do know that Houston was certainly interested in Freud.
I didn't know that. Okay, well, that maybe lends some credence to this theory. But yeah, it's one way to read the movie, if you so choose. I think another theme here that's pretty obvious, right, is, you know, material rewards versus human rewards. Because a major message of Treasure is that, you know, the real treasure in life comes from helping others. And that's suggested by what happens to Howard after he heals this sick boy in the nearby village. You know, he's treated like a king.
Yeah.
And then you think about the bright prospects evident to Curtin, who agrees to aid Cody's widow. And Howard and Curtin, by the end, they're both content with these non-monetary forms of reward or compensation. They're both at peace with the loss of their shares of the gold.
Yeah.
The moral quandary in this film is just delicious. This is a masterclass just in terms of that scene with Cody, the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
This moral quandary that's provoked by an external force. Cody intrudes on their operation. He wants in. You know, the trio has to make this difficult decision about the interloper. Do they kill him? Do they, you know, let him in? Do they run him off? So what do? They vote to kill him. But conveniently for them, this guy Cody, he's killed in a gunfight with Gold Hat and his bandits. But it reveals a lot about Howard and Curtin that they, like Dobbs, they were willing to murder this guy to prevent dilution of their fortune. And so this subplot, I think it really compels viewers to ask themselves, okay, what would you do in this situation? It's maybe not as easy and cut and dried as you think. It maybe reveals something about yourself too. And I'm not going to assume that, you know, the vast majority of viewers are going to say, well, we're going to do the right thing. Maybe not. So I just love that little microcosm example of a moral quandary in the film. And then the end of the movie. To me, it's the best scene in the whole film, because what happens? Howard and Dobbs realize that, you know, the treasure is gone. It has literally been blown away by the winds. And what does Howard do? He just breaks out into this infectious guffaw.
Yeah.
And this speaks to karmic irony. In the end, no one gets the gold.
Oh, laugh, Curtin, old boy. It's a great joke played on us by the Lord or fate or nature, whatever you prefer. But whoever or whatever played it certainly had a sense of humor. The gold has gone back to where we found it. Oh!
It's just so interesting that not even Gold Hat, whose very name and you know, reappearance throughout the story, maybe it makes you think that he's going to prevail with the fortune by the conclusion. Not only are the trio denied the spoils of their toils, but the winds, they scatter this sifted gold dust everywhere, and it makes it irrecoverable to anyone. I just love the cosmic irony of that.
Yeah, I've always liked the end too. Mm-hmm. Andrew Saras basically thought it was kind of cheap, you know, like Houston laughing at his own jokes, I think he said. But what else can you do? There are other movies that, you know, end on people, you know, just laughing or shrugging at fate. And I think this is definitely one of the more effective ones. Although, you know, we also get a coda afterward, you know, where they're sitting and discussing, you know, what they're going to go on and do.
Yeah, it's a fitting conclusion to me. And I don't care what the critics say. I think it's just a perfect ending. I love it.
Yeah.
Real briefly, we're discussing the film Warts and All, just to be fair. So are there any wrinkles you can identify after taking a closer look at Treasure, Farron?
The one thing that was, I am a defender of Max Steiner. I actually love Max Steiner, and I love his you know, his big florid sort of scores. Mm-hmm. But there were a couple of points where I was like, Max, you don't really need to be here. The story goes that, you know, when Betty Davis was doing her big death scene in Dark Victory, she's got a scene where she's going up stairs, you know, to lie down on her bed and die, essentially. And she said, you know, either I'm going up those stairs or Max Steiner is going up those stairs, but we ain't doing it together. In the end, actually, I think she lost, as I recall, that, you know, Max Steiner does go upstairs with her. But yeah, no, there were a few points where I thought, you know, maybe the score was a little overdone.
Okay.
But I just really like the movie the way it is. Mm-hmm. Now, I did come across an article from the New York Times from 1973. I was researching something else. It was about various, you know, anti-discrimination groups, even in 73, pressuring TV stations not to show certain films. Hmm. And one of them was Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which I thought was interesting. It did not go into what their specific problem was, you know, aside okay. just, you know, like from, you know, generalized stereotyping. But I really only see that stereotyping, I guess, in the character of Gold Hat, mm-hmm. you know, like with his very broad accent. I believe it's an untrained actor, you know, with his very broad accent, you know, and his kind of prominent teeth and his pretend stupid manner. You know, Gold Hat is obviously sharp as a tack, but, sure. you know, but he's like, he's pretending to be dumb. Mm-hmm. And all of that is something we've probably seen, you know, maybe too often. But I do think it has to be balanced against what we were talking about earlier. Simply by actually going to Mexico and saying, I want the feel of Mexican streets and Mexican characters
right.
and Mexican actors, John Huston was making a statement. Right. That, you know, I'm not just phony Hollywood is not good enough. I'm going to show some respect by, you know, giving my viewers the real thing.
No, agreed. I think he earns a lot of points there. Again, he casts Mexican actors and non-professional natives in the movie.
Yeah.
Right. There's nobody in brown face here except arguably a young Robert Blake. And yeah, that's kind of rare for this time. So are there ethnic stereotypes? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is there a lack of female roles in the film, primarily wordless women who serve men? Yes, this is an unfortunate trope that continues in this film.
I have to say, I mean, I don't know. That just didn't bother me at all. I mean, it's like Moby Dick, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're not quite on a ship, but, you know, you sure. are in a gold prospecting camp, you know, and like you bring women into that, I'm not really sure how you do it. I would probably dislike more having, like, I don't know, Alexis Smith in there, you know, and
yeah, shoehorned love interest,
in some kind of a bedraggled dance hall girl costume right. or whatever, than I would just not having it there.
No, I'm totally with you. What I'm getting at is, you know, that the only female roles in this film are pretty much wordless women who are at yeah. the, you know, on the arm of men or whatever. You have that prostitute who walks past Dobbs. You have the gold digger, presumably on the arm of the contractor, the guy who owes Curtin and Dobbs money. And you have, of course, the, you know, attractive personal servants who possibly function as Howard's harem.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, it's a story about male characters. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Also, to finish, round out this point, the biggest faux pas is that fist fight sequence in the cantina. You've got stuntmen who look nothing like Bogart, nothing like Tim Holt, and you've got some really bad mismatched cuts between the real actors and their doubles. And to me, that's the biggest visual blemish in a 75-year-old movie. But it's okay. This is kind of standard practice where you'd get the doubles, you know, to do the dirty work, and yeah, the editing could have been a little better, but yeah, it's not, it doesn't lose me. So we are having a 75th birthday party of sorts for this movie. It's fitting to give presents on birthdays, only it's the fans who continue to get the gifts. So what is Treasure the Sierra Madre's greatest gift to viewers?
I think it's a splendidly told, you know, example of studio filmmaking. Obviously, I love old movies, right? But I do admit, you know, not every old movie is going to play right away with everyone. I would say one of Treasure's gifts is that it is pretty easy to love. I would show this to someone with very little experience in watching older movies and feel pretty confident they were still going to enjoy it.
Yeah, that's a good call.
I don't think it's aged. I don't think it requires a lot of apologetics or explanation either. It just is what it is. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with you. Absolutely. I think it continues to resonate as this minimalistic but effective morality play about the repercussions of greed and selfishness and all that, and how it can erode relationships, leave you alienated and vulnerable, ultimately backfire on you. That's an obvious gift. I think we can agree. But, you know, if I were to equate it to, let's say, a train, I think an even bigger gift this movie gives us is to demonstrate to filmmakers and lovers of film alike that the best cinematic stories, they're often the simplest. Treasure of the Sierra Madre, it benefits from some twists and turns, you know, along the way. And if it's a railroad track, there's some twists and turns on that narrative. But this is a train that doesn't have to be the fastest or the newest or maybe the most stylish train to get us from A to B to C. All you need for a thoroughly satisfying ride, Farron, for me, is it's got to be a strong, dependable engine or locomotive in the form of a well-written but streamlined story, compelling characters. I think John Huston and his collaborators, they make things look pretty easy because you've got three strong actors, you've got a solid screenplay, and you've got Mother Nature in the form of the outdoor location shooting. They're doing a lot of the heavy lifting or the heavy pulling, if you will. So there's no merit to me in overthinking Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Yeah.
This isn't rocket science, but sometimes the very best movies are the simplest to understand thematically. Sometimes the very best films are the easiest to follow narratively and the beneficiaries of what? Of good casting and a handful of memorable performances. So you don't have to overthink it. It just works on so many different levels and it has maintained its status as a classic. I agree. So what's keeping you busy lately, Farron? I mean, are there any new or forthcoming projects you'd like to tell us about? And where can Cineversary listeners go to connect maybe with you online or through social media if you want to mention that?
The best way to keep track of me and my writing is probably to subscribe to my Substack, which is still Self-Styled Siren at Substack.
Gotcha.
I'm still on Twitter quite a bit. I have very consistent branding. I'm Self-Styled Siren everywhere, so I'm pretty easy to find.
That's good.
I guess my latest project was doing a Blu-ray commentary for State of the Union.
Oh, Spencer Tracy, Catherine Hepburn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With my good friend Glenn Kenny,
who's also been on our show. Yeah.
And Claire Kenny, his wife. And so we did like a triple threat commentary on that.
Oh,
and that was a lot of fun. Also, my Blu-ray commentary for The Suspect.
Oh, okay.
On Arrow is coming up as part of a 4-disc film noir set.
Very cool.
That they're doing. That's going to be out in March.
And I assume you still make an appearance or two here and there on Criterion?
I hope so. Last year was kind of quiet on that front. I just did the John Ford intro.
Okay.
But it looks like they're reheating things, and hopefully I'll show up again soon.
Oh, I have all the faith in the world. You are excellent in those appearances. So keep up the great work. Farron, our hats off to you for being so generous with your time and your insights and your opinions about this American classic marking a diamond anniversary in 2023. Thanks again ever so much for joining us on Cineversary.
All right. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Whew, we went deep into the gold mine for that discussion, huh?
Weird scenes inside the gold mine.
All right. Keep it down in there, Jim. Farron, we appreciate you and all you had to say about this month's film. Thanks ever so much.
Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's cineverse group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donateCineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. Hear that faraway roar? It's the sound of March, which comes in like a lion but goes out like a giant gorilla. A month from now, we'll be lighting up a heck of a lot of candles to celebrate the birthday of probably the greatest and most beloved film about a giant monster ever made. Yep, it's King Kong, which marks a 90th anniversary in March. And once again, I'll be accompanied by two very special guests, so you won't want to miss it. Until next time, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies, because they're not getting older, they're getting more treasured. You see what I did there with the treasure of the Sierra Madre wordplay there? No, never mind. Thanks for giving us a listen.